This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, January 7th, 2011. In Washington, D.C., I'm Leanne Caldwell. In today's newscast, new jobless numbers are out. The long-term unemployed continue to suffer. We hear from an American teenager captured, detained, and interrogated in Kuwait. And the U.S. places sanctions on Ivory Coast's embattled president. We hear from his challenger, the internationally recognized winner. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with news briefs for FSRN. Healthcare reform was on the floor of the House today in the form of a procedural vote as Republicans pushed to repeal the bill that was passed last year. Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio said Republicans want to allow the return of health insurance industry abuses.
I haven't had a single constituent, and I know you haven't, begged you to bring back these abuses.
The rule vote passed 236 to 181, largely along party lines, clearing the way for a repeal vote on the House floor next week. Doug Cunningham of Workers Independent News has more on the implications of the vote.
Republicans in the U.S. House are pressing ahead with an effort to repeal the Affordable Health Care Act. Now, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says if health care reform is repealed, it will cause a big increase in the federal budget deficit, $230 billion over the next decade, and $1.2 trillion in the decade after that. The same Republicans who say they are so concerned about the deficit are using their first major vote in the House to make that deficit hundreds of billions of dollars worse.
Doug Cunningham of Labor Radio. Iowa Republican Stephen King introduced a bill in Congress this week that would end birthright citizenship guarantees in the U.S. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution guarantees that any person born in the U.S. becomes a citizen. Although the challenge is coming from a Republican, one coalition of conservatives is speaking out against such measures. Pastor Samuel Rodriguez, president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, said today the Republican Party needs to recognize demographic shifts in order to stay viable.
The rhetoric of Representative Stephen King has the potential of amending not only the immigration code, but amending Republican outreach to exclude Hispanics and immigrants.
State lawmakers are also getting in on the game. Earlier this week, lawmakers from five states introduced a framework for overturning birthright citizenship. The U.S. government has repatriated a former Guantanamo detainee to Algeria, even though he said he would rather spend the rest of his life in prison than face extremist violence and retaliation in his home country. Farhi Saeed was cleared of all charges by a U.S. judge in November after being held in Guantanamo for nearly 9 years. Saeed's lawyer said that Saeed asked the U.S. Supreme Court to rule on the legality of the forced transfer, saying by going through with the deportation, quote, the administration has again declared itself above the law.
Those for the bill vote aye, those against the bill vote no.
The Illinois House has voted to abolish the death penalty in the state. With the 60-54 vote, the ban now moves to the state Senate. The Illinois governor put a moratorium on the death penalty 11 years ago after several wrongful death row convictions came to light. And finally, this weekend, residents of southern Sudan will begin voting whether to become independent of the North. The vote is the culmination of a 6-year peace process that ended decades of civil war in the country. Today, rallies happened in Juba, the capital of the South. Many observers in the country predict that the independence measure will pass. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir said this week he would respect the result of the vote. And that's News Briefs for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Leanne Caldwell in Washington, D.C. The president has announced more staff changes today, and all four positions will work on the economy. The top officials, Gene Sperling to head the National Economic Council, which is where he worked under Robert Rubin during the Clinton administration. Progressives are unnerved with this appointment, as Sperling was instrumental in major deregulation of Wall Street in 1999 and played a key role in the recent negotiations on the Bush-era tax cuts. This comes one day after Obama appointed William Daley to be his chief of staff. He served as Clinton's Commerce Secretary, but his last position was executive of J.P. Morgan Chase. Sperling will help to set policy and advise the president on domestic and global economic policy. As for the economy, the latest jobs numbers show that unemployment is down to 9.4%, a rather large decrease from 9.8% in November. That's good news for those who are back in the workforce. President Obama touted the latest figures.
And the jobs numbers released this morning reflect that growth. The economy added more than 100,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate fell sharply.
But for many others, the picture is not so rosy. Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke affirmed that today during testimony before the Senate Budget Committee. He predicted 2011 to be stronger than last year, but said the U.S. economy is going to take 4 to 5 years to get back on its feet. Joining us to talk about unemployment and the economy is Dr. Lauren Applebaum with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at UCLA. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Lauren, on this program and several times with you, we've discussed those who are not included in these unemployment numbers, those long-term unemployed who have stopped looking for jobs. Is there any good news in these latest numbers for those people?
Not really. If anything, the number of people who have dropped out of the labor force has increased. There are 2.6 million people who are marginally attached to the labor force. 1.3 million of them are discouraged workers, people who feel that they've stopped looking because they feel that there just aren't any jobs out there for them. There's an equal 1.3 million who are have left the labor force to either go back to school or to help with family issue, but would take a job tomorrow if offered one.
And is that higher than in recent history?
It's a little bit higher, but it has gone up just a little bit, but it's been around that amount, 2.2 million, 2.3 million, for a very long time now.
Media reports are also saying that the labor market is at its smallest point than it has been since before the recession. But with less people working, that seems like an obvious statement, with more than 8 million jobs that have been lost. Is there anything more to that? Is that significant when we look at these numbers?
Yeah, because the size of the labor force is not just the number of people who are working. It's the number of people who are working and the number of people who are looking for work. So, and when the labor force gets smaller, that's an indication that not only are people out of work, but people have given up looking for work and they've left and they're so discouraged that they feel they won't be able to find any work.
And so that points to that 2.6 million that you just referenced.
Exactly.
Okay. Lauren, also the headlines sound pretty good, and the president seemed pretty pleased about the actual unemployment number, that it dropped 0.4 percentage points. Is that good news? I mean, we talked about the discouraged, but can we look at the 9.4% unemployment and its decrease that as a good thing?
Well, of course, the drop in the unemployment rate is good news, right? We're always happy that if it's not 9.8%, but it's 9.4%, but it's not really a sign of a jobs recovery. The drop in the unemployment rate is in large part due to people dropping out of the labor force. 260,000 people left the labor force last month. And there were a little over 100,000 new jobs created, and that's terrific, but that's just barely enough to account for the regular growth in the labor force that occurs each month. There's about 100,000 people who enter the labor force each month. And so the number of jobs created just barely keeps us even. So if we're seeing a reduction in the unemployment rate, that's because people are leaving. Or else they're trying to start up their own businesses or do something other than work in a regular job. We're still down somewhere around 7.5 or 8 million jobs, plus all of the jobs that were not created during the recession. And so we need somewhere around 11 million jobs to get ourselves back to where we were before the recession began. And at 100,000 jobs a month, we're still just going to hold even with that 11 million. So we need to see the number of jobs each month increase each month significantly in order to see the number of unemployed people go down considerably.
Based on the statistics that come out every month, are we able to tell who it is who's employed and who continues to be left out of the workforce? Mm-hmm.
To some extent, yes. In this last month, the main people who gained employment were people over the age of 55. So nearly 74% of the workers who found jobs were over 55. And this probably indicates that people are delaying retirement, or perhaps women are going back to work if their husbands are unemployed. And if the woman was not in the labor force before, perhaps she's going back. So we certainly see that. We know that that the largest drop in the unemployment rate this last month was among white men. So minorities, people of color, and particularly men of color are really still suffering.
Dr. Lauren Applebaum, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Dr. Lauren Applebaum with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment at the University of California, Los Angeles. President Obama beat the Republicans to massive spending cut proposals and for a part of the budget that has long been untouchable, the military. Defense Secretary Robert Gates announced $78 billion in defense budget cuts, half of that from Army and Marine personnel. The cuts would be implemented in 2015.
These projected reductions are based on an assumption that America's ground combat commitment in Afghanistan would be significantly reduced by the end of 2014, in accordance with the president's strategy.
Congress has to approve the cuts, and some lawmakers have already expressed objection. A 19-year-old U.S. citizen has been detained and allegedly tortured in Kuwait. U.S. officials have put Alexandria, Virginia resident Gulet Muhammad on a no-fly list, which means he's not allowed to return home. The New York Times and Salon reported the story Thursday. Salon's Glenn Greenwald spoke to Muhammad by phone for 50 minutes. Listen carefully. Muhammad is speaking by cell from a detention facility and is very emotionally distraught. Here he describes what happened on December 20th. When he was detained, blindfolded, and taken to an unknown location after a routine visit to a Kuwait airport to have his visa renewed.
And as soon as we got to the airport, I see an American vehicle, so an SUV. I thought it was a GMC, but it was an American. It was like an American cop car, but it didn't say police or anything, or the windows and stuff. So I come, and he opens this and says, get in. I said, didn't you say that I would walk inside Kuwait normal and we would take the handcuffs off me? He said, I know, but we wouldn't ask you questions. I said, I got very scared. And they said, it's in the car, so I had no choice. So I was handcuffed. I can't defend myself. So I went inside the car. And then as soon as he let go inside, I said, Glenn, put your head down. Put my head down. I said, Glenn, we're going to blindfold. They said, Glenn, we will blindfold you. Then I said, why are you guys going to blindfold me? They didn't answer anything for me. They started asking my questions. So they put on the blindfold and took my head down. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know where I was going.
Muhammad left the U.S. in March 2009 to study Arabic and Islam in Yemen. But he said his family was concerned about instability in Yemen and urged him to visit relatives first in Somalia, then Kuwait, where he could continue his studies. Muhammad said he has no prior record with law enforcement and was traveling with a U.S. passport and all necessary visas. Muhammad told Salon's Glenn Greenwald he was repeatedly interrogated and beaten for over a week.
So he hit me, I don't remember how many times, but it started hurting. I started screaming. They say, tell me if you're terrorist. I said, I'm not a terrorist. Why is it going to those countries? I said, I told you why. No, you're lying to us. And they continue me. Then he hit my hands. Then he hit my palms with a stick. I said, why? I kept asking them, what's the reason? Why? What have I committed? I haven't done something wrong. No one told me I've done something wrong. They just, I died for each other's harassment. Each other's torturing me just for the heck of it. Just because they can. So I said, yes, I can speak to the embassy. No, can I speak to the embassy? Can I speak to my mother? They denied me access to my mother, to the embassy. I said, just do it American. No. They said, don't worry.
Mohammed's lawyer, Ghadir Abbas, wrote to the Kuwaiti government last week. Abbas also wrote the Justice Department directly this week, asking whether Mohammed was taken into custody at the behest of American authorities, and if he was, what was being done to protect the American teen from possible abuse by his interrogators. They're calling on the Justice Department to launch a civil rights investigation and for the State Department to facilitate Mohammed's release and provide the protections due to American citizens. You're listening to FSRN. The Obama administration has issued economic sanctions on Ivory Coast embattled incumbent President Laurent Gbagbo, his wife, and some of his close allies. In a sign that the political situation remains fragile, Gbagbo also told the Canadian and British ambassadors to leave the country. Over the last month, at least 210 people have been killed in post-election violence, according to revised figures from the UN. Earlier this week, security forces raided the office of the Ivory Coast Democratic Party, killed one, and detained dozens, whose whereabouts are unknown. There were reports of a breakthrough in negotiations between African leaders and Gbagbo earlier this week, but Gbagbo remains defiant, refusing to cede power to the internationally recognized winner of November's runoff elections, Alassane Ouattara. UN Radio recently spoke to Ouattara, who has been staying in a heavily guarded hotel. Jerry Adams files this report.
Speaking to United Nations Radio, Alassane Ouattara has called on Laurent Gbagbo to respect the ballot box results, which show that he lost the election. Alassane Ouattara said he wants a peaceful solution to the political stalemate.
The election was the way out of the crisis we all accepted. It has taken place and the results are clear. So it is important that we, key players that we are, submit ourselves to the verdict of the ballot boxes.
Mr. Ouattara pointed out that another presidential candidate, former President Aimé Bédié, accepted the fact that he had not received enough votes to be included in a second round of voting.
Laurent Gbagbo should be as magnanimous. He has lost these elections. The fact that the Constitutional Council intervenes, giving numbers which reflect neither the law nor the truth, should not allow him to hold on to power.
Mr. Ouattara said instability in the country following the disputed results have led to widespread violence.
As you know, in the past weeks, citizens have been tracked down by foreign militia and mercenaries. Many people have been murdered. Women have been raped. We have discovered mass graves, and I have asked the army to protect the citizens.
On Wednesday, the UN peacekeeping chief, Alain Leroy, briefed the Security Council following his recent visit to Côte d'Ivoire. He said that in light of the ethnic strife taking place in western parts of the country, the UN Secretariat intended to request that an additional 1,000 to 2,000 troops from the UN mission in Liberia be redeployed to Côte d'Ivoire.
That was UN Radio's Jerry Adams reporting on the political crisis in the Ivory Coast. A group of Mexican human rights activists set out on a caravan today to call public attention to the dangers migrants from Central America face in southern Mexico. Shannon Young has the story from Oaxaca.
Around 30 Mexican human rights defenders and dozens of Central American migrants plan to board the train known as the Beast in the town of Arriaga, Chiapas. Their destination is Chahuites, a town located across the Oaxaca state line, which has become the scene of a number of crimes targeting migrants who use the train system to move north. A group kidnapping last month once again put Chawites in the national spotlight. Migrants arriving at the migrant shelter in Ixtepec, Oaxaca, reported that in the early hours of December 16th, they encountered two groups of armed men along the way. This man, who made it to the Ixtepec shelter the day after the attack, described the incident in video testimony.
El tren de Arriaga salió como a las 8, como...
The train left Arriaga around 8 p.m. Shortly afterwards, we passed a bridge where immigration agents had set up a checkpoint. Almost everyone scattered. Immigration grabbed some while others escaped and were able to get back on the train. Later, about 20 minutes before reaching a town, the train stopped. I saw how about a dozen guys came running out from a stable. I thought they were coyotes coming to look for customers. But no, they were thieves. They started shooting. People started crying and screaming. Another guy got hit with a machete.
More than 40 people remain missing from the December 16th incident. Father Alejandro Solalinde, a Catholic priest who runs the migrant shelter in Ixtepec, helped to organize today's caravan. He says the caravan aims not only to make visible the dangers and risks migrants face along the way, but also to encourage the citizenry to seek ways to reverse the situation. The priest says he wants to see the area's migration route transform from a humanitarian tragedy zone to a place of peace and respect for migrants' rights. At deadline, the train, which was scheduled to leave Arriaga this morning, had not arrived. Caravan members said they would continue to Chawites on foot. Mexico's National Human Rights Commission documented more than 200 group kidnappings of migrants in 2010. With an average of 50 migrants kidnapped each day. The riskiest routes are in the states of Chiapas, Oaxaca, and Tamaulipas. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Over the last 2 years, the EPA has been pushing for new pollution limits in the Chesapeake Bay. The policy, called a Total Maximum Daily Load, or TMDL, has finally been put into action. And after 18 public hearings and 14,000 comments stretching from New York to Virginia, those interested in restoring the bay are pleased with the results. Brad Kuttner has the story.
For decades, Chesapeake Bay has been polluted by waste from agriculture, industry, and urban centers. Earlier agreements to clean up the bay were voluntary, until now. Jeff Corbin is senior advisor to the Region 3 Administrator for the Chesapeake Bay.
We've got a certain amount of pollution, nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment going into the bay and rivers, and we've got to get it down by a specific amount. So we're putting the bay and the rivers on a pollution diet.
EPA worked closely with jurisdictions to come up with a plan that all sides could agree on. Some states' final plans, submitted in early December, still required adjustments by the EPA, such as allocations for wastewater in New York and the agriculture sector in West Virginia. But the final plan has the support of the six bay states and the District of Columbia. With a ballpark figure of $10 to $20 billion for the Baywide project, Corbin says the costs might be high, but they aren't anything states should be surprised by.
EPA TMDL does not impose any new costs. The cleanup strategy is very similar to what all the states have been working on for more than two decades.
Corbin said the costs will be carried mainly by the states, but the Fed will step in the form of grants as well. The plan requires jurisdictions to reduce nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment by 20 to 25%. EPA wants to see 60% of reductions completed by 2017, and all of it by 2025. Corbin said holding violators responsible is key to the policy.
But it's all about accountability. We need to continue to show the public that year after year after year, we can do this over the next 15 years.
Punishment will come in the form of limiting agricultural and animal farming permits, as well as industrial and wastewater permits, all within the power of the EPA. Environmental groups have praised the plan. The Chesapeake Bay Foundation said it's a turning point in the bay's restoration. Mike Jarrell, Chesapeake Bay Foundation scientist.
It's really a monumental event to finally have a real roadmap toward a cleaner bay.
But Jarrell and the Chesapeake Bay Foundation know it's now up to states to uphold the plans they have written. And the states, already burdened with funding issues, could use cost as an excuse.
There's going to be a cost to do this right, but the point that we keep trying to make is that there is a cost to not doing anything.
The next checkpoint for the plan is 2 years from now, when the EPA will examine how far along the bay states are in their plan. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
Juliet Bonds, known to her friends as Judy, was a seventh-generation resident of the mountains of West Virginia, whose family had been coal miners for as long as she could remember. As FSRN reported earlier this week, the environmental activist died Monday of cancer. And today we take some time to look more deeply at her legacy. She inherited her passion for environmental and labor justice from her parents and grandparents, who belonged to the United Mine Workers Union. And when the coal company started strip mining on the mountaintops near her home, Bonds became active in the fight against mountaintop removal. FSRN correspondent Evan Davis, who had met Bonds while covering mountaintop removal, assembled this reflection.
I have dreamed on this mountain since first I was my mother's daughter, and you can't just take my dreams away, and not with me watching.
Seeing these mountains destroyed is stealing who I am, because I am a mountaineer. Even our ancestors were mountaineers. Our ancestors were Scots-Irish that came from the mountains. And so that feeling is embedded deep within us because that's who we are. To watch these mountains be destroyed is to watch ourselves being destroyed.
This old mountain raised my many daughters. Some died young, some are still living.
Coal can never be clean. There's blood on every lump of coal, every lump of coal that's extracted before it even goes to the power plant. Even if you could get rose petals to come out of the smokestacks, as long as you're blowing up mountains, my home, poisoning my people, then coal is filthy. It will always be filthy. Leave it in the ground. It's already sequestered.
For the bosses don't listen to their lies. Us poor folks haven't got a chance unless we organize.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
We are fighting a battle to try to get a wind farm on top of Coal River Mountain. Which would save the top of the mountain, and it would also give us jobs forever. It would give us energy forever. We could still hunt, fish, ginseng, and do the traditional things that mountain folk do on these mountains. And imagine that, us hillbillies from southern West Virginia fighting for alternative energy in the heart of the coal fields.
We will not bow down to exploitation. What you gonna do?
Well, the people that are standing in our way mostly are the corporate regime and government entities, the fascist regime here in America. Corporations own America, and we would like to take our country back as well as our state back. And no place will you find that more evident than here in this state of West Virginia. Coal controls everything. Literally, you know, we have the best politicians coal money can buy here. And that's our obstacle. Our obstacle is the coal industry who has influenced our politicians. And we're literally having to fight our politicians as well for justice, for clean air, clean water, and to live in a terror-free home.
We're gonna keep on walking forward. Keep on walking forward. Keep on walking forward. Never turning back, never turning back.
You just heard a montage of clips from Judy Bonds, environmental activist and seventh generation resident of West Virginia. She died Monday at the age of 58. That segment was produced by Evan Davis and included music from Holly Near, Pete Seeger, Sweet Honey in the Rock, and Judy Small. And that was the program for today. Thank you for your support. And please visit fsrn.org. In Washington, D.C., I'm Leanne Caldwell.